We are in uncharted territory now. We've had a decade of lost opportunity. And for most of that decade, I must say, I didn't have that much hope. But some things have really changed. And one of them is this new report that the International Energy Agency has produced, which says that finally in 2014, we decoupled economic growth globally from emissions growth. And that is a fundamentally important moment. It means clean energy is just wiping the slate now. It's building up so quickly. And, of course, all of the energy efficiency things that we've been doing for years, billions of us, changing the light globes, buying a hybrid car, putting solar panels on your roof, whatever, that is really having an impact now. So that is good news. But beyond that, the real big breakthrough has been what I think is the emergence of this third way. These new technologies that are at a very early stage yet, but which give us the promise of pulling some of the CO2 out of the atmosphere in 20 or 30 years, and so avoiding that 2-degree threshold, the dangerous threshold.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the economics of this, because you do talk about the development of a carbon budget, because there has been so much discussion about the economic impact of divesting from a carbon-heavy industry, from the oil and gas extractive industries, carbon exchange and various different things like that. I mean, talk about what exactly is a carbon budget and how that relates to this moving ahead with a cleaner energy portfolio.
Sure. Look, unfortunately, the political discussions that are going on are all premised around degrees Celsius. So, you know, politicians pledge not to go through a 2-degree threshold and so forth. But another way of looking at this, and it's the way the scientists use, is to frame up a carbon budget and say, well, how much CO2 can we put into the atmosphere before we breach that budget? And it turns out we've got a very limited amount that we can put in. In fact, we'd be totally out of carbon budget by 2028 at the current rate of emissions. And if you compare the carbon budget with the amount of potential CO2 in the ground in identified reserves of fossil fuels, you see that, unfortunately, the amount of fossil fuels we have is something like 5 times greater than the carbon budget. So we know we have to leave most of that. Those fossil fuels in the ground. We can only use a small proportion of the coal, oil and gas that's already valued on the stock market.
And yet, as you said, it's already valued on the stock market. So it seems fundamental to the economic reality of the oil and gas industry that, I mean, right now it seems what's happening is their value is based on extracting 100% of what's in the ground, where the reality is that that just cannot happen.
That's right. And this is exercising the minds of many people, from the governor of the Bank of England through to the CEOs of the top energy companies. They face a real dilemma. And unless we handle this in a staged and very sensible way, of course, it could have big repercussions. But, you know, could I just say, Maeve, you know, the market is moving ahead in any case. I've got a friend who invests in wind power. He just signed a power purchase agreement in Texas to sell electricity from wind at 4 cents a kilowatt hour. 12 months ago, that would have seemed like cloud cuckoo land. Those prices would have been too cheap to make sense. They're not now, because renewables are cutting their costs so fast. So competition with the fossil fuels from these renewable sources is really gathering pace.
Why are we still seeing such lack of political commitment to this? We're gearing up now for another set of climate talks, international talks in Paris just later this month. And there's a lot of scepticism that there will really be any political action coming out as a result of that. I mean, what is behind this global, and I want to say global, but it really is the industrialized nations and particularly the US that has, you know, that is lagging behind, it seems, everybody else when it comes to political action on climate change?
Well, you're quite right. It's frustrating. But the way that the international negotiations are set up, they almost guarantee that the last thing to move will be the national pledges. And that's because we're using a bottom-up approach. So, you know, what's happening is that countries are setting their own emissions targets, looking at, you know, their own industries. And, of course, they're very cautious with that. And we've got these very long review periods. I mean, the Paris meeting, for example, you know, we're trying to decide now about actions that we'll start to take in 2020 and that'll run till 2030. given the pace of technological change and the pace of market change, that's a very cumbersome mechanism. And one of the things we hope to see at Paris is a much shorter review period, say a 3-year review period, so that the nations can get back in together in 3 years' time and say, wow, we're doing pretty well with these emissions reductions. We think we can pledge a bit more. So we hope that the mechanism can change, but as it is, markets and individual people putting solar panels on their roof are always going to move faster than the kind of the sum of all political global negotiations.
Tim Flannery is a best-selling author of The Weather Makers. His latest book is Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. And he'll be speaking about that this evening at 7 p.m. at the Tattered Cover on East Colfax. Tim Flannery, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
It's been a pleasure, Maeve. Thank you.